Our service today is a little different than usual. At the spot where I would usually offer a sermon, today I will instead address questions put forth from all of you. Note that I say address, not answer. There is a distinction. We do this once a year. I think of it as a celebration of questions, our willingness to ask them, to explore them, and sometimes simply to live with them. The process gives us all a chance to learn what's on the minds of folks gathered here, and it also provides some jumping-off places for future services. Jessica was kind enough to sort your offerings into five categories, and of the five categories, those were the ones that were listed earlier. There are none in the politics and current events category. Thank you. But we do have, I think it looks like a fairly even distribution between 1U happenings, theology, Unitarian Universalist beliefs and history, and Reverend Kathy. So let's start with, so many choices here. Let's start with Unitarian Universalist beliefs and history. These seem to be mostly about our elevator speeches. For those of you not familiar with the elevator speech is you're on the top floor of a high rise and you get on and someone sees your UU t-shirt, Unitarian Universalist t-shirt, and says, Unitarian Universalism, what's that? And you've got to floor one to explain it to them. At least enough to get them to want to continue talking to you when you get off the elevators. So you also don't want to scare them in the process. So people wanted to know, are talking about how to explain when they're asked by friends, relatives, coworkers, strangers on the elevator. And one of the questions was, can I hear what other people in the congregation say? And I think that's a great idea. A couple years ago, we offered the class Articulating Your UU Faith. And it's a program, a four-session program that helps people to be able to articulate for themselves. And what was fascinating for me when we did that series was that many of the people who participated were long-time members of the congregation, still seeking the way to explain their faith. And it helps not only to explain Unitarian Universalism, but to talk about their personal faith and also this particular congregation. I am thinking that we're probably due to run that series again. But one of the things that I think was helpful, and without trying to remember what everybody said that day, what I saw people realize is that there isn't one right way to explain it. And that seemed to be very freeing for the people that were participating, that there were lots of different ways. And what is most important is for you to speak from the heart about what is important to you. So I think that that is one of the things that's most important. When I'm talking to someone, Joyce asks, what is my elevator speech? I actually customize mine on the fly depending on who I'm talking to, because it depends a lot on who I'm talking to and if I have the opportunity to know anything about them. I'm going to try to meet them where they are to the degree that I know where that is. Sometimes I'll say, what tradition are you most familiar with? And so that I can talk as a comparison, because sometimes that's just easier for people, and I know what assumptions they're likely to be making, because sometimes the words I say aren't going to mean anything to them, or they're going to assign different meaning to them based on what I do, but on the words that I say based on their past experience. But generally, I say that we're a free religious tradition that draws wisdom from all of the world's religious traditions, as well as all the other sources that the world has to offer. I explain that we're democratic as well. What I say at the beginning of services in the affirmation of our faith, a lot of that is the kinds of things that would come up when I'm talking to someone who's new to Unitarian Universalism. I always remember being in a program with people from other traditions as a student. And one time, one of my Catholic friends said, we were discussing a controversial issue on which Unitarian and Universalists tend to have a different position than Catholics. And he said, well, Kathy, you can't very well have a church where everyone believes something different. And he said it with such conviction that for a minute I thought he was right. I went, wait a minute. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. But I also talk, if we get to have that conversation when we get off the elevator, I also talk about the need to take responsibility for your beliefs. That yes, you're free to be on your own search, but you need to take responsibility for the consequences of the beliefs that you choose to hold. And someone asks, is the worth and dignity of all enough? And they say for them it is. And I think it's interesting that I find a lot of people have a favorite principle, the one that sums it up for them. We tend to have, if you think of our seven principles as an arch with the seventh principle and the first principle anchoring it, the inherent worth and dignity of all people is one of our anchors, and our connection to all of existence is the other anchor. And I find a lot of people will describe themselves as a seventh principle Unitarian Universalist or a first principle Unitarian Universalist. Personally, I'm up in the arch, fourth principle, the keystone that holds it together, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. That's the part that makes me sing. I love them all, but that part makes me sing. So I think that if you took as your mantra the first principle, that worth and dignity of every person, and really lived that, I do think that would be enough, because I think that's a huge challenge. That's a lifetime of work for most of us to find and to look for the worth and dignity of all people. And the last one in this category is, how do we balance our principles of tolerance and a free and open search for truth against our righteousness and outrage for those opinions we deeply disagree with and offend our spiritual values? I think there are two pieces to this. One, I do think that there are beliefs in the world that we can say, these beliefs hurt other people. I think that's okay to say, even when we are tolerant. I think it's okay to lift up why some beliefs actually do harm. But I think we have to offend a little less easily sometimes. I think we have to be willing to live with people who understand the world differently and see the world differently than us and respect that, even if we make different choices. Now, that gets tricky when they have implications in the public arena and public policy. But we can still argue for an open and tolerant perspective, giving people the most freedom to make their own choices within our public arena and be respectful for those people who have a different position. I'll use my own position as an example. I believe it's critically important that women be able to make their own decisions about whether or not to continue a pregnancy. I also understand and respect those people who believe that abortion is wrong. However, in a free society, I believe that that choice must be left to the individual. And we'll continue to argue for that position while respecting the fact that some people will continue to argue against it, which they are free to do, but they are not free to stop people from making their own choice, in my opinion. So that's how I find my balance. But I do think it's a constant balance, and I think it's a good question that we need to ask ourselves periodically. The interesting thing about these categories is they're really kind of blurred. So let's go to theology next. Why do people hurt people? I think, for me, my easiest way of understanding that is that people who are doing the hurt are usually deeply hurt themselves or afraid. They are often, even when it's a righteous fear, like fear that you're going to take something precious from me that I care deeply about, it's still a fear. And the more that we can find ways to interact with each other not from a place of fear, and not in a way that hurts our opponents. Perhaps we could stop thinking of them as our opponents, the more that we'll be able to continue the conversation without perpetuating a cycle of hurting one another and making each other afraid. But that for me is usually underneath it, underneath the bravado, the yelling, and everything else. I think that's really what's going on. Without traditional Christian promise of everlasting life, what do we, you use, offer those facing crises and death? And how do we comfort? I think that we offer most our presence and our companionship and this adventure of being human. I think we offer a listening ear and a validation of people's experience. I think so many people in our culture and in our world feel unheard and alone. And when we can find a way for them to know that there are other people who have walked the path that they're walking before and have been able to do so, that we can give them the courage and the hope to continue walking that path. Within our tradition, there are people who believe lots of different things about what happens after we die. And we aren't dogmatic about that. And my question to people is always, is your understanding of what happens when you die give you comfort? Now, if it does, that's great. And if it's not, then I would encourage you to talk to other people about how they find a different path, because we have a variety. Sometimes we think we all believe the same thing, and we really don't. What we do agree on is that since we can't really know for sure about what happens after we die, that it makes sense to focus on doing the best things that we can here in this life. And that in some way that will help take care of what happens next. So I think it's our presence, our companionship, the sense of community. And that's why it's more important to be together in covenant than to have the exact right beliefs. There's a little recurring theme that seems to have managed to work its way into almost every category here today. Is there a danger that our social justice efforts become a religious doctrine or dogma? And as an example, they say Catholic reverence for the sanctity of life and God's will means no birth control. So do we have our own? I absolutely think that we have our own dogmas and that we can work ourselves into our own little corners. And we have to be really careful about that. We make assumptions about what we all believe on major issues, politics, candidates, and we don't. And it's so often, especially during an election season, that people will come up to me and say, you know, I'm the only one who. And I go, oh, no, you're not. Well, also said that to me today. It's been very rare that I've found that we have one person that's on the dissenting, if you will, the minority view. That doesn't mean that sometimes we don't take a position, though. But I don't think we take positions as a congregation lightly. I'll give you an example from the congregation I served in Massachusetts. It's always easier to talk about people elsewhere than it is about us. We were there at the time when the marriage equality debate dozen years ago was really making a lot of motion, and the congregation had no method for taking a public stand. So at one annual meeting, we took a vote to change our bylaws to say that it would require a 4/5 vote of the congregation. So a real supermajority to take a stand on an issue. And we had one longtime member who argued vehemently against this because he felt it impinged on the right of conscience of the individual. And that's, we said, well, but we still need a a lot of people to agree. And I felt this was important to have this large supermajority, because I, as an individual, if I feel 51% in favor of a topic, I don't go out and do something about it, right? So a congregation that just feels 51% in favor of something ought not be taking a public stand on it. But by the time you get to 4/5, that's a pretty good size chunk. So I don't mind naming him Larry, was argued against it, but he was outvoted. And I will say that that day I knew the congregation had sort of grown up a little, because in the past Larry could get them to vote against, you know, could stop a vote in its tracks. But that day they said, we respect you, but we want to pass this bylaw. Then the next meeting they passed a statement affirming equal marriage. Larry argued vehemently against adopting that statement, even though he'd had multiple letters to the editors in favor of equal marriage. He felt that it violated right of conscience, freedom of conscience. And the congregation said, we love you, Larry, but we need to be a religious voice on this issue, because this is an issue in which other people are claiming to speak for all religious people. And so it's important and relevant for us to have a position on this. And so the congregation did, in fact, take and got over 4/5 vote to take that stand. But I think we need to be careful about our assumptions. And I think even when we take, in that case, the 4/5 vote, we need to respect those people who hold the minority position. Okay. All right. So we have Reverend Kathy and One You Happenings left. We'll go to me first and get that out of the way. How do you feel about eating at Chick-fil-A? I've never actually been inside a Chick-fil-A. They didn't have them where I lived for a long time. And I'd been a vegetarian for a long time by the time I encountered my first Chick-fil-A. And then they happened to have an active political stance that I disagree with, against gay marriage. So that sort of sewed that up. I don't believe in necessarily boycotting any business just because some of the owners have different political views than me, or social views than me. But when they're activists about it and are clearly using the profits of their business to support a view I disagree with, then I wouldn't tend to be there. But I'm not sure they have anything on the menu I could eat anyway. I'm a vegan, for those who don't know, so I don't eat any animal products. What is your definition of being successful? I think the important thing is, in order to be happy, that we have to have our definition of success be consistent with our values. And I think that so often we have different parts of our brains operating, and so we have one idea of what it means to be successful, and it's often defined by somebody else. And so I don't think there's one particular view, but if you find that you're getting all the way to success and you're climbing some ladder and you're getting less and less happy, then I would say that your definition of success is wrong. That the question is, how can you be successful while living your values? And I think that that is the most important part of any definition of success for me. We'll put these two together. How do you decide what to take off your plate, and how are you doing with this particular professional challenge? Our professional organization, the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association, has a new coaching program where it's always had mentors for new ministers, but now it has a coaching program for experienced ministers. So I signed up for that last fall, and after a few delays, I actually met by email my new coach this year, and we'll have our first phone conversation on Wednesday. And I'm really looking forward to it. So he sent me a questionnaire to answer. You know, and it had the standard stuff, you know, what are you trying to accomplish? Tell me a little bit about yourself, some specifics. But then at the end, there were these questions that said things like, as part of our coaching, I will ask you to make certain commitments. What will the excuse be that you give me when you fail to live up to them? And you know, I knew exactly what the answer was. I knew the answer was, well, I'll be too busy. There will have been a crisis. And then he said, and so what should we do when you give me those answers? I was like, I don't know if this guy and I are going to get along. But honestly, I do, because it is a challenge for me. One of the things that I really struggle with, I am blessed to love my work. I am blessed to love my work and the people that I work with. And so it's very hard for me to say no to the things that seem like reasonable requests. And I am very challenged by my to-do list. And people are very understanding. I have to say this is just a lovely group of people in understanding that I can't do everything. So that I admit that the challenge lives inside me to be more discerning. And right now I tend to be sort of what's in my face is what gets the attention. And that often, in hindsight, I've missed opportunities that I really would have liked to take. And so I would like to become more intentional and discerning about taking things off my plate. Right now they kind of fall off. And there was a time when things fell off and I knew they'd fallen off, but now sometimes things fall off and I don't know they've fallen off. And that concerns me because I want to at least let someone know if I'm not going to do something they've asked me to do. So that is a challenge that I'm working with. Thanks for asking. So the next question is, what do you predict will be the biggest, best benefit from having an intern, and also the trickiest and the most negative? So for those of you who haven't sort of gotten the buzz, the board is going to be coming to the congregation with a proposal that we get a ministerial intern for starting a year from now, so September 2014 to May of 2015. I've always wanted to be a ministerial intern supervisor, so I would really love that. It's an interesting wash, they say, from a time perspective, because you have to do supervision and a lot of other things, so you don't actually save time in this way, but for me, and so that would probably be the trickiest. The negative is that it would take some extra work to bring a person up to speed. But the benefit, I think, would be in having the congregation have ministry from another individual, have the congregation be part of helping to form another minister for our movement, which I think is a very exciting thing to be part of. And I think for me to have a colleague to talk with and to bounce ideas of and to have sort of that fresh perspective that someone newly coming through school would bring to conversation. I think that would be a real gift to me and to the congregation. I think these two are related. I have to read them out loud to find out. What is your vision for 1U's role in Central Florida's social justice efforts? And what community partnerships would you like to see 1U make, and why? Do you have a vision or dream for how we might find and make these partnerships? I definitely would love to see us continue to make partnerships. I think we already have some really wonderful partnerships that we work with in different parts of the community. Planned Parenthood will be our Share the Plate partner next month. We work, especially the Alliance, works very closely with the Coalition for the Homeless. We've worked a lot with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and we work with the Hope Community Center. Those are four people that we'll be supporting in our Share the Plate program this year, and that we have developed continuing relationships with. For me, a great thing about community partnerships, as I look forward to us being even more out in the community, because I think we already do a really good job with that, but being more out in the communities, we don't have to invent everything. Some of these people, they're very specialized in something we care about. So we don't have to make it up. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can support their efforts. And we can look at it and say, what do we bring? What do we bring to this conversation? How can we supplement what you are doing? When we work with Planned Parenthood, it makes a difference because we're a religious voice. So they're not a religious institution. We are, but our partnership together makes a stronger message. And I think there are lots of ways that we can do that. Hope Community Center works with the farm workers and immigrants up in Apopka, and they work from a Catholic perspective. But we have a great partnership with them as we can find common ground in looking for fair treatment of all people. So what I would like to find is ways that we can express our values so that we are putting forward our values. Our mission statement says we exemplify liberal religion. So what does that mean? How does that look in our time and place? Now, we might hear about another Unitarian Universalist congregation in another part of the world, and they're not up the road from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. We are. So that's something that we are especially called to. There are different issues in different places. So when we look at what we're going to do, I would like us to be out in the community, but also a space that provides people, where people know they can come to First Unitarian and know that wonderful justice and peacemaking activities are going on here. When I first got to Orlando, there were a couple of experiences that I had over and over again, and I've mentioned some of them, but people talking about, you know, their first time on this campus, long before they were ever a member, was to come to a GLBT youth support group or to some interesting talk or to the meeting of another group that we were providing space for. I think when we make ourselves available to groups that have a hard time finding a home elsewhere in the community, that's speaking to our values and supporting them. So I hope we'll continue to look for those partnerships and be very intentional and create a vibrant relationship with the wider world in that way. All right, I think I'm now off the hook. Just double check. Don't want anybody to feel left out. Okay, good. All right. Just a couple minutes to do one U. I'm wondering why people clap after the band or individual sing during service. It makes it seem more like a performance than part of a service. Thank you. I know that some of you think this, but I'm going to tell you what a lot of other people have said. Oh, it's such a relief to come someplace where we're allowed to clap. Seriously, I have had that conversation a lot with people. And here's what I think. I think they want to participate. And I think this is especially true of younger people in our world today. They don't want to come and sit. And actually, it feels like the symphony to me when nobody claps. Because it's like, oh, we're following the rules of etiquette here. We're not doing the thing we're supposed to do. To me, I'm having an experience of joy if something was beautiful, and I actually want to applaud. Now, I went neutral for a long time. The first 12 years of my ministry, especially in public, I didn't care what happened. I didn't stop applause, but I didn't do it. I was trying to, like, cater to everybody. But you know what? Now I'm going to tell you, I think it's a sign of joy and participation. Sometimes. If it's reflective music, there are times it's not appropriate. I don't think we have to applaud after everything, and I think this congregation makes good choices. But I actually find it pretty stifling sometimes when I feel like I can't. So I know I'm not on the same page with a lot of people, but I just need to be out there with that one. Is there a way the youth of 1U could hear some of our wonderful musical presentations? One of the casualties of having our religious education program during the 11 o'clock hour is that we've needed to move the offering to later in the service. For the first couple years, we had it before they left. We had the offering before they left so that they were able to hear the music. And that was a really wonderful thing, intentionally done so that they also had the experience of experiencing the offering and the idea of generosity and what they would learn from that. But the music as well was a great gift. Their teachers want them for a whole hour, and so we need to get them out of the sanctuary. But we can certainly look for opportunities to have music earlier. And when we have special music, to sometimes invite them to stay, you know, negotiate with their teachers for their time. Oh gosh. We have a number, there's about three questions that are about our ability to welcome different sorts of people. Someone wanting to be able to invite their friends. Are we welcoming to children and adults with special needs? Comment that there were less than 10 people of color in the room the morning after the Trayvon Martin verdict. And are we welcoming in that arena as well? Related to that, it says at 1U we have groups, couples, dinners, retired men, children's programs. Are we practicing separate and unequal? So let me take those as a batch. Every congregation, every religious tradition, every group of people have their own culture, and it takes intention to be something other than that culture. And so I think that's something that we're trying to be intentional about. It's okay to be who we are, but what we want and what we need to be looking at is, are we unintentionally giving a message of unwelcome to other people, whatever that might be? I know conversation I had with someone who's a mother of young children recently said, what do we do when there are children in the service who are doing more than making an occasional squeak? We don't want the parents to feel unwelcome, and yet at some point, allowing a child to make a continual noise is unwelcoming to people who can't hear the service, especially people using hearing assistance devices. So how do we balance that? And I think the way we do it is by having conversations, and we say to people, tell us what makes it hard for you to be here. Tell us what message we're giving you that is telling you that you're kind of on the outside here. I think we have to keep having those conversations, because even when we think we have it right, there's always more for us to learn. Sort of like the little girls in the story, the princesses in the story this morning. They each could only see their particular view. And we need the opportunity to hear other people's views and see what the world looks like and what our congregation looks like from them. So I hope we will continue to do that. I think we have lots of opportunity to continue to grow in that area. I did want to speak to the separate groups. I think there are times when it is really important for people to come together around an issue that bonds them, whether it's by gender, sexual orientation, age. I think there are times to be together in those special groups because you have special concerns and there are special for the children, there are things that are developmentally appropriate. I've been in a congregation where the children were in the entire service the entire morning every week. Those children are not getting, to me, as rich an experience as they can have by having some of their morning be with their peer groups. That said, I want the children with us for part of the time, and I don't want people in their affinity groups to have that be their only experience of church. We need to cross out of those groups too. So I don't see it as an either or. I don't see it as segregation. I see it as a both and. Can you have this rich experience of being in a group that a small group that has this particular focus, and can you also joyfully be part of the larger group? I think those are both important. And just one last quick wrap up. Someone looking for a new spiritual home asks, what are the strengths of First Unitarian? Well, I'm prejudiced, but I think that it's a really wonderful, warm group of people. I think they have been very generous with me in the 3 years that I have been here, generous of heart. Theologically, I don't have to watch every little word that I say. I feel like I can stumble and be accepted. I hope that members of the congregation feel that way too. I think that we offer a lot of different ways to be involved, whether education or out in the world or taking care of our community here. And it's a place where you can explore and figure out who you are and where you are on your spiritual journey. We come from so many different paths, but once we're here together, we're not all on the same path. We're sort of on these parallel paths that sort of weave in and out of each other, and it's a beautiful thing. And if you find that you want to step over to another path for a little while, you're welcome to do that while still being part of this community. And so I think there's a lot to explore for someone who really wants to engage and take active responsibility for their own spiritual journey. I think you'll find many resources and much support and love.